KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
This is something that could be worked with. It's also something that could be the basis for a terrible deal. We just don't know yet.
Russian and American diplomats are meeting face-to-face in Saudi Arabia.
They are talking about the future of Ukraine and some broader topics, too.
For Tuesday, February 18th, it's All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump froze funding for the United States Global Anti-AIDS Program.
What does that mean for public health efforts?
We are going to see regression on that progress because the virus does not stop. It doesn't care what the politics are.
And as the Trump administration pushes talks with Russia and critiques America's European allies, we'll look at how those new dynamics are playing in Germany's upcoming elections.
Russia would, within a short period of time, build a massive army, and that would be a formidable challenge to European security.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. When Trump administration officials met their Russian counterparts in Saudi Arabia today, they did not only discuss Russia's war against Ukraine, they also talked about the restrictions on the U.S. and Russian embassies in Moscow and Washington. NPR's Michelle Kelman has more on that.
The war in Ukraine, spy scandals, and tit-for-tat steps have taken a toll on the U.S. embassy in Moscow. Russia forced the U.S. to close down consulates and does not allow the U.S. to hire local Russians as staff. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says he's trying to change that.
There's been a series of reciprocal actions taken over the last 10 years that have really diminished our ability to operate in Moscow, as an example, and they would argue their ability to operate in Washington. We're going to need to have vibrant diplomatic missions that are able to function normally in order to be able to continue these conduits.
He and his Russian counterpart have set up a working group to address this, and Rubio says he hopes it can move quickly. Michelle Kelleman, NPR News, Washington.
Trump later today claimed Ukraine started the war against Russia, despite Russia's invasion of that country nearly 3 years ago. A legal victory today for the cost-cutting initiative known as the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. A federal judge is refusing to immediately stop Elon Musk's team from accessing government systems and laying off personnel. As NPR's Bobby Allen explains, the judge did raise concerns about the legality of Musk's work at the White House.
14 states sued to prevent DOGE from accessing government data and participating in laying off thousands of government workers. The states argued that only an official who was nominated by President Trump and confirmed by the Senate can have that much power. Judge Tanya Chutkan in Washington notes that Musk's actions appear to be precisely the executive abuses the Constitution intended to prevent, but she would not issue a temporary restraining order, saying the state's request lacked evidence. While Musk is the public face of DOGE, the White House now says in court papers that Elon Musk is not its leader. Trump officials have not publicly stated who is running DOGE. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
At least 14 people are dead from flooding and freezing temperatures over the past 4 days in Kentucky. Karen Czar with member station WKY reports an unknown number of people are still stranded without power.
Crews on Black Hawk helicopters and Swiftwater rescue boats have been working around the clock since late Saturday, evacuating Kentuckians from flood water. Governor Andy Beshear was on the ground in eastern Kentucky Monday, where nearly 300 people were rescued from two apartment complexes.
I was there at Little Sandy at the airport with these families getting off, thankful that they were safe and really grateful. For the National Guard of our state of Tennessee, of Indiana.
Beshear said there are still people unaccounted for, and it could be days before there is an accurate count. For NPR News, I'm Karen Czar in Frankfort, Kentucky.
On Wall Street, the Dow closed up 10 points today. You're listening to NPR. Hundreds of artists signed a letter to the National Endowment for the Arts today, asking it to reverse changes made to the agency's grant-making policies as a result of recent executive orders issued by President Trump. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports.
The letter specifically calls for the NEA to roll back new rules that require applicants to abide by two of Trump's executive orders, one that eliminates diversity, equity, and inclusion as a factor in grant-making, the other that targets transgender and other LGBTQ plus programming. Writer and director Annie Dawson spearheaded the effort.
We all like to think of this being a country where artists have the right to self-expression, as we all do. This action by the NEA is concerning because it seems to suggest that through these weird executive orders and the applications of them to certain agencies, freedom is being taken away.
In an email to NPR, an NEA spokesperson said the agency did not receive the letter and added that the NEA, as a federal agency, will fully comply with the law. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
The Brazilian government says it's approved joining OPEC Plus, the group of major oil exporting countries. Move coming as Brazil looks to become a major exporting state. Brazil was invited to join OPEC, which coordinates oil production and looks to stabilize global markets. Brazil's President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has touted himself as an environmental leader working to reduce deforestation in the Amazon, but has also argued oil revenues could help his country transition to green energy more quickly. Crude oil futures prices closed higher today. Oil up $1.10 a barrel to $71.84 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Until now, the U.S. has been trying to isolate Russia over its war against Ukraine. But today, in Saudi Arabia, top Trump administration officials sat down with representatives of Vladimir Putin's Kremlin. They both called it a productive and solid meeting. Ukraine was not at the table, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
After several hours of talks in Riyadh, Secretary of State Marco Rubio came away convinced that Russia is ready to begin what he calls a serious process to bring about an end to the war in Ukraine. And he says the world should be thanking President Trump.
No one else has been able to bring something together like what we saw today because Donald Trump is the only leader in the world that can. So no one is being sidelined here. But President Trump is in a position that he campaigned on to initiate a process that could bring about an end to this conflict.
The meeting was a follow-up to a phone call between Presidents Trump and Putin. The two men are expected to meet in person, but the U.S. and Russia have not yet set a date. They agreed to set up a working group on Ukraine to find a solution that is, in Rubio's words, acceptable to all sides. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov called the conversation very useful. We not only listened, but also heard one another, Lavrov told reporters, and he says he believes the Americans have begun to better understand Vladimir Putin's positions. Ukraine's president was due in Saudi Arabia this week, but put off the trip until March 10th, saying he wants a fair deal, not one negotiated behind Ukraine's back. The statements coming out of the meetings in Riyadh also did not thrill Daniel Freed, a retired U.S. diplomat who now works with the Atlantic Council, a Washington think tank, but Freed stopped short of criticizing the administration for this initial diplomatic outreach.
This is something that could be worked with. It's also something that could be the basis for a terrible deal. We just don't know yet.
Trump administration officials often talk about peace through strength, a phrase that harkens back to the anti-Soviet Reagan era. Freed, who served in the U.S. Embassy in the Soviet Union and focused on Russia throughout his long career at the State Department, says the Trump team will certainly be tested by Moscow.
The test of peace through strength will come when the Russian conditions become known, and it becomes clear, as I suspect it will be, that they have no intention of solving this except on their terms. At that point, the Trump people will have to decide whether they're stare down the Russians, and then we will see. That test will come.
Freed spoke to NPR from Brussels, where Europeans are worried that the Trump team might force Ukraine to make concessions without getting much in return from the aggressor, Russia.
And I've been encouraging the Europeans not to just wring their hands and complain, but think what they're going to put on the table.
The UK and France are already proposing troops and some security guarantees. Trump's national security advisor, Mike Waltz, told reporters in Riyadh that the U.S. is counting on Europe and continuing to consult with the Europeans.
We all have to contribute to our common defense, and we expect that this to be a two-way street for our European allies. And the fact that both the United Kingdom, France, and others are talking about contributing more forcefully to Ukraine's security, we think is a good thing.
But Russia's foreign minister says he told Waltz and Rubio that any European Union or NATO force in Ukraine would be unacceptable to Putin. Lavrov also repeated Moscow's line that Ukraine should never become part of NATO. Trump administration officials have already ceded that in public. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
South Africa has more people living with HIV than any other country. Some 8 million people infected with the virus that causes AIDS. So when President Trump froze all global health aid last month, the impact for those working on the ground to fight the disease was profound. That is because PEPFAR, the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, contributes about $400 million a year to programs in South Africa. Linda Gale-Becker runs one of those programs. She is director of the Desmond Tutu HIV Center in Cape Town, which counts on U.S. dollars for some 80% of its funding. When we reached her today in Cape Town, I asked, how'd she first hear of the freeze on foreign aid? What was her first thought?
Well, we received a what is now very well known as a stop work order. And this we received on the 27th of January. And I think it's absolutely correct to say we were completely caught off guard. And it took some time for us to understand exactly what that meant, but then became very clear that this meant no work, no spending, no activities at all, and that all staff would have to be put on furlough or in some kind of suspended work situation. This meant that in clinics, counselors would suddenly be, you know, off the floor. Certain clinics were completely closed. Other treatment programs were shut down. Extraordinary impact literally from one day to the next.
So the funding freeze has been lifted for now, temporarily. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says there are supposed to be waivers for life-saving medicine. Is the money flowing? Have any doors reopened?
So the way certainly the treatment, care, and prevention programs work within the PEPFAR house, if you like, is the funding flows either through USAID mm-hmm. or through CDC. So the
Centers
CDC,
for Disease Control and Prevention.
Correct. Yep. So the CDC component has issued some instructions to people. And so there is some movement towards reopening and resuming activities on that side. But the USAID side, there have been occasional messages to either say the stop work order remains in place, please abide with it. Others have said, you know, hold on, we're coming. But, you know, there really has been very little communication from USAID.
So I want to understand the stakes here. South Africa, I mean, all sub-Saharan Africa in general, has been the epicenter of the HIV crisis for so long. But in recent years, there was so much progress. AIDS-related deaths have plummeted. New infections have plummeted because of the availability of prevention drugs and treatments. Do you worry this current situation could threaten that progress?
Profoundly, Marie-Louise. I mean, PEPFAR, I was there at the time when PEPFAR kicked in 2003. It was truly an emergency and an incredible lifesaver. And the first very important component of this was just to save young lives, keep families together, make sure that breadwinners continued to be able to provide, and very importantly, that children who were dying in droves would have their lives saved. More recently, we've been making progress, one, towards self-reliance as a country, but secondly, also to bringing this epidemic under control. I am very concerned that by stopping this the way it has stopped, we are going to see regression on that progress, because the virus does not stop. It doesn't care what the politics are.
So what would you say to the argument that
America has plenty of problems here at home. America has to take care of Americans first. And something like PEPFAR is not going to be something that the U.S. is going to fund going forward. I mean, what is the argument for what the U.S. might gain by investing in programs like this?
I mean, I think there are a number, and I want to say this with heartfelt sincerity. PEPFAR and other programs that USAID and, you know, and America has provided for the global community is what made and makes America great, in my opinion. It truly does set the country apart as an extraordinary world leader. The incredible expertise that has been generated by having the resources, the ability to treat, the ability to keep our health systems together has enabled us to be able to pivot when other epidemics and problems have come along. And you know, there's no doubt we are likely to see more of these. So perhaps my comment is that, you know, we've built an amazing global expertise, a global understanding of communicable diseases, which affect the globe as a whole. And I think that's important to acknowledge as well as a sort of a dividend, if you like, of this investment.
Linda Gill Becker, thank you.
Real pleasure. Thank you.
She is director of the Desmond Tutu HIV Center in Cape Town, South Africa.
Thousands of people around the country protested actions by President Donald Trump and billionaire Elon Musk yesterday. One of those protests was a dance outside the Kennedy Center. Trump recently ousted the Kennedy Center's leaders and named himself its chair. NPR's Elizabeth Blair has more.
34 dancers bundled up in their wool hats, coats, and gloves lined up single file along the front entrance of the Kennedy Center. When the music started, they began to walk, making simple, synchronized gestures with their arms. Organizers chose a work by Pina Bausch because the choreography was easy to master in a short time.
For us, it felt symbolic in that we're moving in unison, all together in solidarity.
Kelly King is a dancer and educator in D.C. who organized the march. She says the diversity of the Kennedy Center's dance programming has been a beacon of light for dancers both locally and around the world. She's worried that will change under the leadership President Trump has chosen for the Kennedy Center.
I really wanted to take the opportunity to pull the dance community together to flex the muscle.
A spokesperson says there are no plans to change dance programming at the Kennedy Center, but King isn't taking any chances. She says she's already organizing another dance protest. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Thank you. Support for NPR comes from this station and from your part-time controller, the Nonprofit Accounting Specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Some news today about the Israeli hostages in Gaza. Hamas says it has agreed to Israel's request to speed up the hostages' release as part of their ceasefire agreement. On Thursday, Hamas will hand over the bodies of four hostages, and on Saturday, Hamas will free six more living hostages. All of them were supposed to be freed by the end of the month. We have NPR's Daniel Estrin on the line from Tel Aviv. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, Scott.
So tell us more about the hostages Hamas has agreed to free this week.
Well, Hamas will hand over the bodies of four hostages to Israel on Thursday. Hamas has not named them all, but they say that they include the remains of the Bibas family. This is a family whose story is widely known in Israel. It was a young couple with two young sons, 4 years old and 9 months old, when they were taken hostage in the Hamas attack on October 7th, 2023. The father was released alive this month, but Hamas has said that the mother and kids were killed in an Israeli strike a month into the Gaza war. Now, Israel never confirmed that, so there had been some hopes that they were still alive. So that's going to happen on Thursday, and then on Saturday, six live hostages will be released. They include an aspiring actor, a restaurant manager, a real estate guy, all in their 20s, also a 40-year-old father, and two citizens of Israel who have been held captive by Hamas for 9 and 10 years. They are Hamas's longest held hostages.
Wow. We mentioned that this is a speedier timeline than before. Why is that? Why has Hamas agreed to speed this up?
Well, Israel was pressing for it. Israel has been concerned about the condition of the remaining hostages in Gaza. It's also been very agonizing for the Israeli public to watch this get drawn out, hostages getting released in small groups of three every week, masked militants parading them onto a stage. Some of the hostages have been gaunt and lost tons of weight in captivity. And plus, Israel had been holding up something Hamas really wanted, and finally Israel has relented, and it will allow mobile homes into Gaza for those people whose homes were destroyed in Israeli strikes during the war. And also Israel will allow in heavy machinery to unearth the bodies of Palestinians buried under rubble. Israel is also going to continue its part of the deal and release Palestinian detainees and prisoners. But it will be a very emotional roller coaster of a week in Israel. This is going to be the first time Hamas is handing over bodies. And then a few days later, we will see some living hostages released. And then the next week, Hamas is going to release four more bodies.
And remind us of where we are here, big picture. Where are we in the ceasefire agreement, and how many hostages will remain if what you just laid out all goes according to plan?
Well, this is just stage one of the ceasefire deal. It expires in less than 2 weeks on March 2nd. And if all of this goes to plan, there will still be 59 hostages remaining in Gaza. Nearly half of them have been confirmed dead. Now, Hamas says it's ready to begin negotiations immediately for the next phase of the ceasefire, for more exchanges of hostages and prisoners, and for a full pullout of Israeli troops from Gaza. What we don't know is what Israel is prepared to do. Far-right members of Israel's government actually want to go back to war in Gaza against Hamas, and they've threatened to quit the government if the next stage of the ceasefire takes place. So Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, his political survival really is on the line here.
U.S. has been a big player in this all along. Obviously, a lot of major policy changes over the last month or so in the United States. What has the American role been in all of this?
Well, Secretary of State Marco Rubio was just here in the region. We do know the Trump administration wants to see the second phase of the ceasefire happen, but Netanyahu's political partners want to go back to war, and the U.S. actually has just sent new arms to Israel.
That is NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Germans head to the polls on Sunday for a national election, with President Trump calling for an end to the war in Ukraine and for Europe to step up its defense spending, many German voters are worried their country has not done enough to defend itself. NPR Berlin correspondent Rob Schmitz takes us to the port city of Hamburg, where the military is training German industry for war.
In 1665, Hamburg was one of Europe's richest cities. It was filled with merchants conducting trade from the city's port near the North Sea. But that year, says the city's Chamber of Commerce CEO Malte Heine, Hamburg's merchants were faced with a big problem: pirates arriving from present-day Algeria.
And the government wasn't able to protect this, the merchant vessels, so the merchant decided to set up the chamber.
Hamburg's merchants pooled their money together to purchase three warships that patrolled the port, establishing Germany's oldest chamber of commerce in the process. 360 years later, Hamburg's Chamber of Commerce has 187,000 businesses with more than a million members, and security is still top of mind. Heine says his members are preparing for a variety of scenarios.
Russia is trying to attack the Baltic states, for example. What's happening then? So we need to be ready for that scenario, which hopefully won't happen.
Another institution preparing for this scenario, the Bundeswehr, Germany's military. Kurt Leonards is commanding officer of the Hamburg Regional Command of Germany's Armed Forces.
We see that the war industry in Russia is working, and a part of it, of the products, go to the Russian-Ukraine war.
And the rest of Russia's weaponry, says Leonards, is being put into storage.
So that we think that Russia is in 4 or 5 years able to test NATO.
Leonard says NATO member states are already being tested through so-called hybrid attacks, like cyber attacks on German businesses. Leonard says he's advising companies in Hamburg how to prepare for these types of attacks and for scenarios involving Russian attacks on NATO allies. For example, he says many logistics companies in Hamburg employ truck drivers from Eastern European countries that border Russia.
And in a crisis, it could be that these people are also called by their forces and not anymore here in Germany.
For many Germans, this war prep might seem extreme, but according to Guntram Wulff, former CEO of the German Council on Foreign Relations, this is precisely the way Germans need to think when it comes to Russia.
It has better trained forces, it has learned on the battlefield. And so imagine a scenario in which there was to be a ceasefire in Ukraine, and Russia would essentially continue its production at the current rates.
In a report Wolf authored in September as a fellow at the Kiel Institute, he and his team discovered that Russian weapons production is so strong that it can match Germany's entire stocks of weapons from 2021 within just 7 months. Wolf says if Russia and Ukraine were to agree on a ceasefire, Russia's firepower would grow.
I mean, if that were to happen, Russia would, within a short period of time, build a massive army that is really well equipped and has lots of ammunition. And that would be a formidable a challenge to European security.
Germany currently spends just above 2% of its annual GDP on its military, but Wolf says it'll need to spend well over 3% to deter Russia. President Trump has demanded NATO members like Germany spend at least 5%. Regardless of how the upcoming national election goes, experts say making the painful investment needed to bring the country's military up to speed will remain Germany's biggest challenge. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Hamburg.
This is NPR News.
As German voters head to the polls, the country's economy is still in a recession.
Globalization is in retreat. Chinese want to produce for themselves. Americans want to produce for themselves. The euro is still there, okay. We have to take care of our own military now, and the cheap energy supplies from Russia are gone as well.
That story tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Coming up, the story of a Syrian soccer player who became the poster child for the Syrian revolution.
What our reporter Emily Fang found when she went looking in the Syrian city of Homs.
First, this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. In Gaza, Hamas says it will hand over the bodies of four Israeli hostages on Thursday and six living hostages on Saturday. Israel had asked Hamas to speed up the release. As we hear from NPR's Daniel Estrin.
Hamas says on Thursday it will give Israel the bodies of four hostages, including those of the Bibas family. Shiri Bibas and her two young children, aged four and nearly one when they were captured, have long been feared dead. On Saturday, Hamas says it will release all six living hostages it had committed to freeing by the end of February, including two hostages held in Gaza for about a decade. Next week, Hamas is expected to give Israel four more hostages' bodies. After that, 59 hostages will remain in Gaza, nearly half of them confirmed dead. In return, Israel says it's allowing mobile homes into Gaza for those whose homes were destroyed, plus heavy machinery to retrieve bodies buried under rubble. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The Vatican says Pope Francis has pneumonia in both lungs. NPR's Sarah Venturi reports there's concern about the ability of the 88-year-old pontiffs to fight off the infection.
The Vatican says laboratory tests, chest x-ray, and the Holy Father's clinical condition continue to present a complex picture. A CT scan showing pneumonia has caused them to adjust his treatment, which now includes antibiotic and drug therapy. Francis had part of one lung removed after a pulmonary infection as a young man and is prone to bouts of bronchitis in the winter. Now he's reported to be in fair condition and is said to be eating breakfast every day, reading the newspapers, and even doing some work from the hospital. Given his condition, some Vatican events have been canceled. There will be no weekly general audience on Wednesday, and it's not clear if Francis will miss his Sunday noon blessing for a second week in a row.
This is NPR. The late country music legend Loretta Lynn is coming to Broadway in a stage adaptation of Coal Miner's Daughter. The 1980 film about the singer's life won Sissy Spacek an Oscar. Here's Jeff London.
Coal Miner's Daughter was very much a musical film. It featured many songs made famous by Loretta Lynn.
Well, I was born to call.
The Broadway show will follow the singer's rise from hardscrabble beginnings in rural Kentucky to becoming a country music star. It will be overseen by a couple of Broadway stalwarts, director Sam Gold and music supervisor Janine Tesori, who collaborated on the Tony Award-winning musical Fun Home. Georgia-born Sutton Foster, who last appeared on Broadway in Once Upon a Mattress and Sweeney Todd, will get to show off her range singing a variety of country music hits. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
From bakeries to farms, skyrocketing egg prices are posing a big challenge to small businesses as the spread of avian flu has forced farmers to slaughter millions of chickens, causing egg shortages and price hikes. It's just one of the many hurdles small mom-and-pop restaurants face, and if the problem persists, they could be forced to raise the cost of egg products just like the big restaurant chains have. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station
And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes, to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. It has been a tense day in New York City as Governor Kathy Hochul and other top officials weigh the political future of the city's embattled mayor, Eric Adams. Adams faces growing calls to step down over allegations of corruption and over criticism that his deepening ties with the Trump administration have compromised his ability to govern independently. NPR's Brian Man is following this. Hey there.
Hi, Mary Louise.
So get us up to speed. Governor Hochul was signaling yesterday that she was weighing using her power to force Adams out. Did she move in that direction today?
Well, here's what we know. Hochul spent the day holding closed-door one-on-one meetings with some of New York City's most influential politicians and civic leaders, including the Reverend Al Sharpton and Congressman Hakeem Jeffries. He's the House Democratic Minority Leader. He represents part of Brooklyn. And they discussed Adams' future and this growing scandal that sent shockwaves through the city's leadership. Remember, four of Adams' top aides and deputy mayors, some of his key staff, resigned yesterday. Mm-hmm. So in her statement, Hochul said Adams' alleged conduct at City Hall is troubling and cannot be ignored. She made it clear that removing Adams from office is a real possibility, but so far she has not pulled that trigger.
Okay, tell me more about the conversations that she was having and just the tone.
Yeah, louder and louder calls from Democratic leaders in New York for Adams to resign or for Hochul to force him out. Congressman Jeffries spoke to reporters today after his conversation with Hochul. He says confidence in Adams' ability to lead has been shattered. This interview was posted by the news channel New York One.
It's a deeply disturbing development. Mayor Adams has a responsibility to decisively demonstrate to the people of New York City that he has the capacity to continue to govern in the best interest of New Yorkers, as opposed to taking orders from the Trump administration.
Taking orders from the Trump administration. Brian, just refresh our memory on what Hakeem Jeffries is referring to.
Yeah, so Mayor Adams was indicted last September on federal corruption and bribery charges. He's denied any wrongdoing. But after President Trump was elected, Adams and his legal team started courting Trump's team and the new leadership at the Justice Department. They looked for those very serious charges to be dropped. Critics, including one DOJ attorney, say Adams' team offered a quid pro quo here. You know, shelve these criminal charges, and in return, New York City's administration will help crack down on undocumented migrants. So last week, the DOJ did agree to put Adams' case on hold. That was a move so controversial that seven top DOJ attorneys resigned rather than go along with it. Now moving forward, because the DOJ has reserved authority to reactivate those criminal charges against Adams, they're holding this big stick going forward. If Adams doesn't cooperate on migrants, the DOJ could hit him with those charges. Adams has already offered federal immigration police more access to inmates at the city's jail on Rikers Island.
And is there any kind of deadline for Governor Hochul? Like, do we know when she might act?
You know, we really do not know when she's going to move forward here. One key moment, though, is Judge Dale Ho, the federal judge overseeing the Adams case, is going to review the DOJ request to put these criminal charges on hold. That happens tomorrow afternoon. And there's some indication that Hochul might act after we hear how that judge moves the case forward.
NPR's Brian Mann, he is watching developments in New York City. Thank you.
Thank you.
Pope Francis is still hospitalized with what doctors describe as a, quote, complex picture that now includes pneumonia in both lungs. Despite his illness, the 88-year-old pontiff has managed to keep in touch with a Catholic parish in Gaza from his hospital bed, as he's done throughout the war there. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports from Rome.
Father Gabriel Romanelli says in an interview posted on Vatican News that Pope Francis has called from hospital at the same time he always calls.
Nonostante che abbiamo avuto un blackout in tutta questa zona di Gaza City.
Even though there was a power blackout in Gaza, he says, the Pope kept trying to get through until he was able to speak with the parishioners in a video call and send everyone there his blessings.
Quindi lui ha ringraziato e ha dato la sua benedizione.
The Pope has maintained near daily contact with leaders in the Catholic Church in Gaza throughout the recent war between Israel and Hamas that has killed at least 48,000 Palestinians.
Abbiamo sentito la sua voce come sempre, è vero, un po' più stanco.
Father Romanelli says the Pope had sounded a little more tired than usual when he rang from hospital and that the Pope had acknowledged that he needed to take care of himself. The 88-year-old pontiff has been suffering from a respiratory infection for more than a week and has been in hospital for several days.
Invece ieri, domenica, mi ha inviato un messaggio scritto al mio cellulare.
Romanelli says on Sunday the Pope texted him instead of calling and thanked him for all the prayers he was receiving from Gaza. The Vatican said today that doctors are now describing the Pope's condition as a, quote, complex clinical situation. It said in a press release that a chest scan demonstrates the onset of bilateral pneumonia. As a young adult, Pope Francis had part of one lung removed after he developed pleurisy. The Vatican says, despite these challenges, the Pope remains in a good mood and continues to pray. On a scratchy phone line from Gaza, George Anton, the head of the emergency committee of the Catholic Church there, describes for NPR the scene when Pope Francis called every day.
Hundreds of people here in the church, they hear him every day.
More than 500 people took refuge in the compound of the Holy Family Church in Gaza to shelter from the intense Israeli aerial bombardments. When there's enough power, parishioners would project the Pope's video calls onto a big screen.
He's asking us about everything. What do we eat? How is the situation of the water? How is the situation of the health sectors? Everything, you know.
UN officials warned in the war between Israel and Hamas that over 500,000 Gazans were one step away from famine. Pope Francis has been outspoken in his criticism of Israel's military campaign in Gaza. Last month, he described the humanitarian situation there as, quote, shameful, and he said there should be an investigation into whether Israel's actions in Gaza constitute genocide.
The wartime was very horrible for us, you know, and it was something that makes us feel like we're facing death every day, you know, but his phones every day makes us feel like we have a father. We have someone who's really protecting us and listening to us through all this mess here in Gaza, you know.
Now there's a ceasefire in Gaza, and Anton says he and all the parishioners there are thinking about their Holy Father.
We love him so much. We have a real father.
They're all praying, he says, that he will get better very soon. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Every week, a famous guest draws a card from the wild card deck and answers a big question about their life. Comedian Ronnie Chang says he is still in pursuit of the perfect joke. You can see his latest attempt in his Netflix comedy special, Love to Hate It. Or you can watch him star alongside Jimmy O. Yang in Hulu's Interior Chinatown. The Crazy Rich Asians actor talked to wild card host Rachel Martin about his journey from law school student to Daily Show correspondent.
What was a disappointing experience that now feels like a blessing?
I couldn't get a job coming out of law school. My grades were too bad, and I couldn't get hired, and everyone around me was getting jobs because I went to a very good law school, so everyone around me was like this very hyper-competitive type A people who were getting really good jobs at these big law firms. And I felt a little left out at the time. But in hindsight, I'm like, oh man, I'm so glad I never got hired, because I think it would have been more difficult for me to quit a job and do comedy. As it was, I didn't have anything to lose, so I could just do comedy. It wasn't like I had to pick between comedy and a corporate job. I never had to make that decision because I never got hired. So
were your parents disappointed that didn't pan out for you?
They weren't, because I never told them.
What do you mean?
I just didn't tell them I was doing comedy. They thought I was studying for the bar exam, which I was, in fairness. But in that time, I was just doing comedy. And by the time they found out, it was almost like too late.
Wait, that's awesome.
That's the secret.
Led this separate life. But you were, I mean, assuming you were in a good enough place that when they found out, they weren't traumatized. You're like, I'm a comedian and I can pay my rent. So it's okay.
Yes. They only found out, honestly, when I got hired on The Daily Show.
What?
Yeah.
But, wow. Yeah. Did they know what The Daily Show was?
No, they didn't know. They didn't know what it was. And then like a couple days later, they Googled it. They found out all about it. They were like, oh, you know, this is an important show. This is a very famous show. And I'm like, yeah, I know. I know. They kind of trained me to be like, it's just an opportunity. It doesn't mean you're good. it just means you have a chance to do something cool, right? Like that's all it was. So that's what I took it for. And that's really what the strength of being on The Daily Show is. Like, more so than fame or whatever, it's like this opportunity to work with extremely talented people and really become better yourself. Because everyone at that show is so good at their jobs that you don't want to be the weakest link, and so you lift your game. So that's really that's why it's the best job in comedy. You know, it just makes you a better writer, performer, comedian, satirist. You know, that show is, it's like the Harvard Business School of comedy.
And you can hear more of that conversation with Ronnie Chang on the Wildcard Podcast.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. NPR's Emily Fang recently wrapped up a reporting trip to Syria. And as Syrians celebrated the end of Bashar al-Assad's regime, she kept seeing one man's face everywhere. She wanted to know who he was, so she and NPR's Jawad Rezala went looking.
I saw him on Syrian flags, on posters, on the sides of buses and cars. And then I heard him everywhere, too. In cell phone ringtones and on loudspeakers. And I learned his name, Abdul Basit al-Sarut. People sang his songs to me in jubilation on the streets, even children. Al-Sarut was already beloved for playing on Syria's youth soccer team, and his untrained voice channeled the public's anger into action and into protests against the old regime run by the Assad family. Even when government snipers started firing on demonstrators, Al-Sarut became the poster child of the revolution. I wanted to find out more about him, except he was killed in 2019. But I heard a name when I visited the northern Syrian city of Homs, a man people said wrote Al-Sarut songs. And so we tracked him down.
Ayman al-Masri, Abu Samir.
This is Ayman al-Masri. He's a sedate man with heavily lidded eyes. Before the revolution, he sold car parts and owned a cake factory. But when the anti-government protests kicked off in 2011, he became a revolutionary and a writer. He started penning chants and lyrics for activists. I wrote for a lot of singers, Al-Masri tells me. But Al-Sarut had a special charisma and kindness. The hint of a rare smile arches Al-Masri's lips. He understood me, and I him, Al-Masri says. If Al-Sarut was the revolution saint, Al-Masri was its scribe. Al-Masri wound up writing all of the singers some 130 chants and songs, including this one. To glory and dignity and chivalry, Al-Sarut sings. Homs, his beloved city, will save Arab honor. The pair met when the singer quite literally walked through this store, Al-Masri's former home in central Homs. Al-Masri remembers it had been around midday. The singer was fleeing government soldiers after a protest. Al-Masri's home in the early days of the revolution was known as a safe haven. And so Al-Sarut stumbled in, looking for a place to hide. Al-Masri recognized him immediately as Syria's famous soccer goalkeeper. Al-Masri said at that point he had a bunch of lyrics, but he'd been looking for the right person to give voice to them. And so, on that very day, in his living room, the two men forged a creative partnership. Today, the house where they met is a bombed-out shell.
We're standing outside of a shelled house, bullet marks on the walls. It used to be pink, but the paint has faded now.
It was struck and raided several times by Assad's forces. Everything Al-Masri once owned went up in flames. Later, the regime destroyed his cake business as well, in retaliation for his lyrics. We walked the streets of Homs with Al-Masri. He showed us where he and Al-Sarut protested and sang, despite numerous assassination attempts. Those days were the pinnacle of happiness, the sweetest of my life, Al-Masri tells me. Al-Masri and the singer became famous for their music, but they had to go into hiding. Al-Masri says they never spent more than a few nights in any one place. Then they went underground, literally. They paid to obtain a map of the city's sewage system. The two traversed the front lines of the urban guerrilla war that had consumed the city of Homs by that point. They crossed enemy lines through the city's sewage tunnels, emerging from grates in the dead of night to meet so Al-Masri could give Al-Sarut his newest lyrics. Here they are practicing together in 2013. Holed up together during the siege of Homs, a major offensive that laid waste to much of the city.
Around then, Al-Masri says the two men, who had once been so in sync, started to diverge. Al-Masri, a committed pacifist, believed his pen was his most powerful weapon. But by 2012, Al-Sarut had picked up a gun. He decided to become an opposition fighter. Here's his childhood friend and former teammate, Rayed Al-Khalid. Al-Khalid says Al-Sarut saw no other way to resist a regime that was increasingly murderous. Al-Khalid spent almost 7 years fighting alongside Al-Sarut. He watched as his joyful, big-hearted friend tired and hardened. Al-Sarut struggled with the death and destruction, but he increasingly advocated for violence over singing as his preferred tool for regime change. Al-Khalid says Al-Sarut often prayed that he would die fighting. His father and five brothers had all been killed. In 2019, Al-Sarut got his wish. He'd been fighting in northern Syria when he was badly injured in a drone strike. Al-Khalid was among the soldiers who evacuated him to Turkey for treatment. Abdelbaset Al-Sarut died of his injuries the next day. He didn't live to see the revolution he'd sung for succeed. Al-Khalid did, but in his joy, he feels like there's an entire chapter still missing, he says. Al-Sarut is missing, he says. And Al-Masri, the lyricist, is now a songwriter without his singer. Today, he wanders homes and sees the past. Al-Sarut's scent, his presence, is everywhere in homes, Al-Masri says. There is no street here that we have not walked down together. We get in a car and head to what remains of the singer's family home.
This is the house here.
One that the kids are playing on?
Yes.
The regime destroyed much of it, but the memory of Al-Sarut is very much alive here. A gaggle of children, some born after Al-Sarut died, surrounds me as I approach. Who lived here, I ask them. Abdelbaset Al-Sarut, they say. Al-Masri is next to me. He's carrying a worn, spiral-bound A4 notebook. The notebook where he hand-wrote most of the first songs Al-Sarut sang. Opening his notebook, he reads one of his and Al-Sarut's chants. The wall's been blown open, so we face the setting sun. My companions have gone ahead of me, he recites. We will live on, for this world is fleeting. Al-Masri has started writing again since the regime fell, he tells me. His new songs are different, though. They're about life and hope and rebuilding. Emily Fang, NPR News, Homs, Syria.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday. Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/iulab. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options. At progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from EC.